Oh yeah, welcome back. Episode 61 of Prestige Performance. I am buzzing to be joined by a man who has become a mainstay of the Irish music scene over the last 20 years. This man has recorded 4 albums, multiple platinum records, including number ones. He represented Ireland, of course, in the Eurovision Song Contest in 2003. It is, of course, Mickey Joe Hart. Mickey, you are extremely welcome to my podcast. How are things, man?
Hi, Jimmy. How are you doing? I'm great. Things are great, thank God. Yeah, everything's really good. I'm very happy. Life is good. Just had a bit of a holiday in the States. Kind of back now and a few gigs since that. Just trying to get motivated.
Were you playing any shows in the States? Or?
No, I was kind of, well, I did an album in Chicago in 2011. We released it here in 2012, so we released it there and here. And so the producer was from Chicago, and a lot of the musicians they used, well, although it was a very acoustic affair, the musicians they used in the studio and all those kind of people were all, you know, local based. So I had a gig in Chicago just to reconnect with them, and they organized it also. It was very easy. I just got in and done a set, and there were 2 or 3 bands that they were all involved in, and we had a great day. Lovely. So, but no, it was just a holiday, basically, you know, more or less, and then a few little things like that, you know. But I really enjoyed that, just to reconnect with the guys, you know. And the venue was part of the studio upstairs that we recorded the album in the time. So it's just good. Yeah.
Tell me about growing up. What's the context we need to know in relation to the path you took in pursuing a career in music?
Oh, right. Well, it's quite complex. And I'm actually reading a book by Paul Brady. You mentioned it a minute. And Paul's from, you know, grew up in Strabane. And I grew up in Lifford. And Lifford is in Donegal on the Republic of Ireland side. And Strabane is in Northern Ireland, on the Northern Ireland side, if you know what I mean. And they're just separated by the river. I mean, so there's a lot of interaction between Strabane and Lifford, you know, over the years. Back then, there was big barriers, and you had the British soldiers there with stuff in place. And, you know, so you had to go over and back, and you might have been searched, you might have been checked, all those kind of things. So I suppose growing up, I was in the shadow or the backdrop of that all the time. It didn't seem abnormal to us. It seemed, you know, when I look back, I felt quite normal. We were just growing up as kids, but when I look back now, it was horrendous stuff that was going on around us, you know, at the time. So so I suppose just in the backdrop of that, that was probably primarily my upbringing. But a great community, Lifford, where I grew up, fantastic community, great festivals, great sense of community, and a lot of people locally, musicians and fellas who were just into music, sort of giving me a pat on the back and sort of saying, "No, you're good at this, go and do it," you know, and getting me a gig here and there, a few friends, you know, that were involved in music or managing bands and stuff, and, you know, just giving me a support gig or giving me a gig, you know. Lifford and Strabane, I think, like, the whole pub scene when I was growing up, and this is, I have to go back, this is the sort of, you know, late 80s, early 90s, you know, when I'm doing a lot of the pub scene. I mean, I started gigging when I was 15, so my cousins had a pub called Hart's Bar in Lifford, and so I started out pretty much there, kind of been around the pubs, and then just doing the clubs and the circus. And then I was fairly quickly had a band on the road. We were doing a lot of weddings and everything else. So I was about 17 maybe at that stage. So yeah, and I'll be 50 soon, so you can do the math. So yeah, you know, I've been that's kind of the backdrop of where I grew up. But I had a great community, and I was very lucky. Great pub network when we were growing up as kids. There still is in Ireland, and it's very unique in that way. Ireland, you know, I've never seen it anywhere else. There was pub gigs everywhere, you know, in the world, or there's venues. But, you know, that sort of pub culture of singing is a great place to learn your trade. And I think that's why we have so many good sort of, you know, we bat sort of above our weight, or, you know, if you know what I mean, in terms of, you know, being able to hold a stage, being able to hold an audience, and being able to go out there and do it, have to have, you know, there's a certain standard that you have to reach, there's, you know, to get to, you know, over the years. And the pubs were great at just kind of, and the clubs and all those kind of gigs and festivals and stuff were great at just fine-tuning you and knocking the ages off you and trying, you know, knocking you into shape in terms of, you know, being a performer, knowing how to put a song across, and knowing how to deal with an audience, and knowing how to deal with some of the shit that you get, and, you know, that you have to deal with, and sort of toughens you up a bit, and you know, your skin's a bit thicker, and you know, that kind of carves you and shapes you. So I suppose that's from a, you know, in a kind of a quick nutshell, you know, how I grew up and how I sort of started out, you know.
I'm guessing as a young man gigging in pubs initially, you've tasted both sides of it. So you probably had the full pubs full of crack and playing to no one.
Yeah.
It's tough.
It still happens. It doesn't matter. Still happening. I did a festival recently, I would say, but it was, there was a small audience. They were very vocal and it was nice, but it was a small audience. And it was a tough, you know, thing to do on the street, you know, and you have to go and you still have to go, you know, if there's two there, 2,000, you still have to try and, you know, just put your best foot forward and do the same set or do, you know, do as, put as much as you can. And it's not always easy that way, but it's just, I think over the years you realize that that's important to be able to do that, you know. Yeah. Whatever's in front of you, you entertain and you play to try and bring them with you on the wee journey as you're having, you know, on stage. So yeah, so still happens, but yeah, absolutely. I know what it's like to play the full rooms, and I know what it's like to play the empty rooms, and you know, that's part and parcel of being a musician, or, you know, at a certain level.
My Springsteen
doesn't have to deal with that.
my quiet gigs wouldn't be 20,000 now; they'd probably be 20.
Yeah, I know. Me too. So I mean, it's just the way it is, you know. It's funny, in Ireland, there's so much going on in Ireland at the minute, and you know, there's so many options now for gigs and for festivals, and people have loads of options, and then you know that tends to dilute your audience a bit as well. So you know, there's not as many, you know, as I say, when we started out, there was a pub kind of scene, and everybody went to the pubs, and that's where pubs are closed, and that's where kind of, where it was at, and you know, that's where people went. You know, there wasn't so much diversity in, I suppose, entertainment, and you know, people that are sitting at home watching box sets now, you know, it was never a thing back then. You know, I mean, it was just people went to the pub or went out, you know, enjoyed a band, went to the festivals. So there's a huge amount of choice out there for people now, you know, in terms of everything, you know, in terms of holidays and being able to go foreign with a drop of a hat and all them kind of things. That, so that all affects your pool of people, I suppose, your audience, you know, and who's there, you know, and the amount of people. I mean, we live in a small country, really, and there's a huge amount of things going on. So to try and win an audience into a venue is an achievement, you know.
Who inspired you growing up? I know obviously Paul Brady was one, but who else were you listening to?
I was inspired primarily by, first of all, by kind of people, family members, you know. My brother was sang and wrote songs, and he had a real flair for that, still does. And I had a cousin who was married to a woman up the street. She lived up the street, and she played and sang in competitions. So there's always musicians about. My uncle was in a band. My cousins on my mom's side were all kind of in bands, and you know, there's bits and pieces that they were all. My uncle's sons and before had a band called The Loth, kind of a heavy kind of rock indie band. You know, there's lots of that. My auntie on one side then was on stage. She did a bit of theatre. She did a bit of acting. My dad's sister, and you know, so there was always those kind of elements. My uncle was in a band playing drums and stuff. So you know, a sort of a wedding band, pub bandy kind of thing, you know, as well. But so he would have helped me as well to get gigs and stuff. But so primarily I was influenced by those people, you know, growing up, and there would have been musicians about the house, and that would have been the strongest influences. And then I suppose the musician terms, you know, the likely ones, the likes of the, you know, the Police, and you know, I liked Suzanne Vega and people like that. There was singer songwriters kind of stuff that was happening, and Melissa Etheridge, who was an American artist who a lot of people probably wouldn't know, but I kind of stumbled upon her when I was young, and I thought, oh, this is something very different, you know. Singer songwriters like that, Van Morrison, and people like that as well, and then Paul Reedy was probably my biggest sort of influence, even. And still is, you know, a huge influence. John Hyatt, I got into him. He's an American songwriter. So a lot of the American kind of singer-songwriters, some of the English bands, that we were hearing, and just a lot of stuff on the radio. Yeah, that would have been kind of primarily my influence, was singer songwritery type things, you know, like the kind of Suzanne Vegas and stuff that came out of, you know, but it would have been stuff that my brothers and sisters were listening to, and then things I was buying myself, you know, along the way. I used to kind of have a pilgrimage every Saturday over to Strabane, because Lifford was on the other side of the bridge and over to Strabane, but there was a big shopping town in Strabane, although there was a lot of stuff going on in the north at the time, you know, it was just, we just, that's what we did. We all went over and back there. And there used to be a couple of really good record shops there, so I used to kind of save up during the week or get up whatever I could and go and buy albums, and the guys in the shops would know what I was in, you know, kind of in the music, and they'd be kind of saying, I'll try this. And that's how I got into Melissa Etheridge, actually. The guy, this guy in the shop just said to me, try, listen to this. And it was all vinyl I was buying as well. Cassettes. But yeah, primarily, mostly vinyl, 45s and, you know, LPs and stuff. So it was a treat to come back with something to stick it on and play it, you know. And Chris Rea and people like that, you know.
Different world now, isn't it? Vinyls and records, it's all Spotify now.
Yeah, it's a completely different thing, all right. And, you know, I'm struggling to figure it all out and try and keep on top of it. And it's, you know, for me, it's kind of one of those chores, feeling like a chore. It didn't feel like a chore when we were releasing records. It's weird, you know, when you were putting a record out, recording an album, going to the studio, and you knew at the end of the process, okay, I had to get this album out, you know, through a distributor or whatever it might be, a label or your own label, and you know, and that was that. And then you did a tour sort of to promote the album, single or whatever it is, and you know, and then you put on radio, as much radio and all that kind of process. But now there's a million different things that you can take, you know, what do? Do you put it on, you know, YouTube, Spotify, websites, you know, you've got Instas, Facebooks, and that's just five off the top of my head. You have so many other platforms. Where do you put your time and energy? It's very hard to decide. And, you know, I know there are obvious ones, but then, you know, and then, you know, it's who's the cleverest at following the trends, following the, whatever you call those things. I can't remember the spikes and the troughs, and all those kind of things. And you know, kind of equipping yourself for that, you need like a team of people to sort of keep you on board like that. And I don't have that team of people. I have my manager, we have a bit of help, all right, with it. But it's so hard to know. But you know, I think that ultimately the songs and the tunes and will help to sort of get you through that, you know, because if you get a buzz going, you can create something out of just a good track and a good song. And that's kind of what I'm hoping still will get you to out to an audience, and that's what I try and do. And I'm just working at the minute on trying to get a new album together, and it's, you know, just trying to keep motivated to do that. Yeah. So get some new singles out, and so for next year. So that's my motivation at the minute, is to get another album. I haven't done an album, an original album, you know. So though I've had a lot of projects and a lot of singles and bits and pieces, I haven't actually put a full body of work together. So that's where my focus is at the minute. So, but then, you know, you don't know. People say, well, is it not better just to release singles, keep releasing singles? And kind of, for me, I need to do a body of work again soon. You know, that's just you know, as a kind of a personal thing too. Yeah.
You know, when I shared this on Instagram that I was speaking to you, I got a lot of replies, a lot of DMs. I suppose people in Ireland, they hold a lot of love for you. And what I find really interesting is that a lot of them are in their early 20s. And if you think of Eurostar, that's 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And I remember, as I was saying to you before we came on to this, I was 11 for that final, and I robbed my father's phone to vote for you because I didn't actually have a phone at the time.
Imagine.
More than 1 million people viewed in to watch that. And when I was looking up my research for this, I read that the crime rate actually dropped in Ireland that night as well. That's mad, isn't it? You're the only man to stop the crime in Ireland.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Myself and Simon had a great crack. Simon Casey was in the final with me, you know. And it was just, you know, it was, it's all a blur, you know. Those hazy days, kind of looking back now, and it's kind of hard to believe it's 20 years, you know. But it was one of those things that we found ourselves kind of just in the middle of, and very quickly, and it snowballed out of all proportions in terms of, like, you know, it just came out of nowhere. I always tell the story that I remember the first, when I got through, I went very reluctantly down to Derry to do the audition. And the only reason was my aunt, my mum's sister. She had sort of reminded my mum, oh, tell Mickey to go down for this. You know, he has to go down because there's really good people involved. Now, I heard Phil Coulter and Louis Walsh and EMI Records. There was a guy called Darren Smith who was on. I thought, okay, well, there's definitely a few heavy hitters in this. That kind of, I was intrigued to see what this, more than anything, thinking, you know, I'll have a look at nothing else. And I was the last person into the audition in Derry. I had a gig in Glenties that night, which, if you know the geography, is quite a far distance away, so I'll say to Donegal. And I was late getting out, or not late, but I was, maybe didn't get out of the audition to the last 7 or 8 o'clock. And I had a ball sort of go from Derry to Glenties and do a gig. But then I got the call to say, yeah, come down tomorrow or the next day. And then it just kept going like that. But I remember trying, when I got through to the TV, first TV stage, the kind of regional thing, and I rang some of the local journalists that I know, trying to get a bit of, you know, support for it. And they were saying, what's it called? What's the program called? And, you know, trying to really sell it to them. And you get a little piece on page 14, you know, a little sort of bit about it. And then once this program started, about 3 or 4 weeks into it, it just went crazy. You know, I mean, every time you switch your phone on or whatever, there'd be like, you know, 20 messages from journalists and people looking to get that new code system. Just, it exploded like that. So it was like, and something that I'd never obviously, you know, you don't have any preparation for that. You just kind of have to try and roll with it and figure it out as you go along. But yeah, so it was that whole process, and then ended up in the final assignment. It was bizarre.
I suppose originally, that wasn't really the direction you wanted to go, was it? So were you hoping just to get a bit of exposure, or that was your thinking, was it?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I had a manager. I'm still the same manager, Shay, and we had, I'd done this EP. We had a bit of interest from Warner Brothers, a few up around Dublin. I'd done some gigs and stuff. We were getting a bit of interest, and he was kind of plugging away at that. And then I'd done this EP, kind of another version of, you know, sort of keep reeling them in a bit, you know. And we were just about to release that, and I'd done all the artwork and everything for that. And this, the Eurostar thing came out of the, and I went down for the audition. I didn't tell. I just went on a literally on a Sunday evening. Like, I think it was a woman that came in, and, you know, I got this message, go to this thing. I said, okay, I'll go down and check it out. And I went down and literally rang him up the next day and says, listen, I went to this competition called Eurostar. I know what's going to be like. He says, okay. I said, but it's TV and stuff. I said, and I've got through, you know, they've asked me back in. And he says, well, listen, you know, you never know what happens. And sure, if we get a few weeks on the TV, it'll be good exposure. And hopefully, they'll, you know, do whatever, you do your own thing or whatever. And it might give us in front of the record label. We didn't. So that was the idea completely. I think, you know, yeah. But I had this all the EP, everything ready to roll, and that we kind of then just put on hold for a little while. And then the next thing, the whole Eurostar thing kind of just exploded. So yeah, that was it. And it wasn't the direction. It was kind of very singer-songwriter type. You know, I come out of the rock school in Ballyfermot, so it was very much that focus and that mind. Just doing my own thing and pursuing that. And I was a solo artist, and I had a band previous to that, and we were doing everything from, you know, wakes to weddings, as they say, and all that kind of stuff. And there was a great club circuit, nighttime club circuit in the north or Northern Ireland, where you go to all these kind of places, late night places, 10 or 12 to 2 kind of places. Larne and Ballymena and Portadown and Derry and, you know, all these different towns around, and into Belfast, places like that. So I was doing that circuit with the band, then that broke up, then I was doing the solo thing, and I had very much so been focused on that for the singer-songwriter type thing. And I was taking a different direction, and then Eurostar came out, and then We've Got the World, and it was a whole different thing for me. Yeah. Really.
You mentioned We've Got the World there. A lot of the messages I got on Instagram were, Jesus, tell him We've Got the World. It's a banger. It's become somewhat of an anthem in Ireland, hasn't it? But what I want to know is, four albums, all the songs you wrote, collaborated with people like Paul Brady, does it ever frustrate you, or did it ever, that maybe you were best associated for that one song?
Sometimes, you know, you think like that, and but on the other hand, it's like, I have to be very thankful. You know, I know so many very, very, very talented people, way more talented than me, that would give their right arms to have a song, have that, you know, hit, you know, that song that keeps on kind of giving, if I can be as crude as that with it. Like, you know, this year again, I did an Irish version with the guys from Cahill and the guys from Today FM, Dermot and Dave show and all that. There's a whole kind of, we done a whole, you know, we got another number one out of it 20 years later. And it's like, so we done an Ask Gaelic version. So it's like one of those songs, and it keeps finding, as you said, like maybe people are texting into you in their 20s, and that wouldn't mathematically work out. It's kind of the song keeps finding a new audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or whatever. So, and that's just, you know, that's great. You can't knock that. And I wouldn't ever, you know. So, yeah, there are times you think, Jesus, did it, you know, pull you in a direction maybe you didn't want to go. But I was able to piggyback a lot of stuff off the back of it as well. And, you know, to be honest, and be able to do a lot of things that I would never have been able to had it not been for that song and, you know, for that association with it. You know, a lot of people get songs and through shows or into Eurovision, and they're basically never heard of again, or, you know, the song's never heard of. You know, it's something that, you know, doesn't connect with people, and We've Got the World connected with people, and it still does, and, you know, it's still out there banging it out every gig.
Yeah, I mean, so, and it still is capturing a new audience.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, so it's just, I don't think too much about it like that anymore. I just see the positives. It's like 3 or 4 minutes, 5 minutes of maybe an hour and a half or 2 hour set, depending on what it is. And that's, you know, but people come to hear it. If you don't do it, you know, you'll be lynched. But it's, you know, I enjoy it, and I'm doing it with so many solo gigs I'm doing it these days for the last little while. And I just kind of do a version of it that I have fun with it, get people to sing along, have fun with it. I really enjoy it. It's amazing. You know, I just kind of sit back sometimes, and 20 years later, and I'm looking at the audience, and they shouldn't really know this song, you know, so a lot of the times, and I'm just going like, you know, just enjoy the moment and enjoy it. You know, I've learned to sort of take that, you know, and enjoy it, and, you know, take it for what it is. And that's it. I don't look any further than that anymore. And it's been a good vehicle for me for other things. You know, that's how I see it. So it's all positive in that respect nowadays. You know.
How did life change after you were a star? I mean, you became a star overnight, like.
Yeah. Star, I take that with a pinch of salt.
Ah, you did. You did. I mean, the message I got on Instagram, people have such love for you still, like.
Well, that's lovely to hear. It really is. Very nice. It's just one of those things. It's not, you know, the star or the recognition or the celebrity kind of thing that comes with it, if you want to put it like that, you know, or the recognition or whatever. I don't know how you term that. So, but it's never something that I craved. I thought it would be nice, and some parts of it is nice, but overall, that's not why I do it. You know, and it's not, and if that part wasn't involved, I'd still be doing music. You know, that's not why I get up in the morning and do, you know, what I do, and write songs and try and, you know, and play gigs and do that whole thing. I just know that that's where I'm happiest in my life. You know, that's what I do best, I think, is, you know, sing and perform and play. I can't, never found anything as fulfilling in life. You know, what you lose in one hand, you gain in the other. So, you know, are we ever completely 100% happy with what we do? You know, I mean, like, you know, in life, you know, you're always questioning things, but I know that's where I'm happiest, and that's where I get the most satisfaction out of. It's just when I have a good gig and I come back in and I sit down in my hotel or whatever it is, or and drive home and say, Jesus, that was good tonight. I really got something. And And that's where my inspiration and energy comes out of, you know, in terms of like, you know, writing and performing and trying to find the next project or the next thing, the next song. It's a whole pile of things. Sorry, I've kind of lost my train of thought there. You were asked, what did you ask me about stardom and star, about being a star, about how it affected my life. It changes your life completely in some ways. And then in other ways, it didn't really affect my life that much, you know, because, you know, things in my life, a lot of the things have stayed the same, still are, thank God. But luckily enough, I didn't lose those. Like my family and people like that didn't, and friends, I still seemed to have the same kind of people around me. So I didn't piss them off too much, hopefully, at the time. It affects you. It's learning to deal with it and learning to know that it's all white noise, you know, it's all nonsense, all that stuff that goes on around, and, you know, and to try and keep centered, that's the thing, try and keep doing what you primarily, what brought you there in the first place, and that was singing and performing and writing songs. You have to remember that's where, trying to get back to the center, but sometimes you get lost in all that. Particularly when it's a big TV show and there's a lot of people involved, a lot of people asking you to do and telling you you're brilliant, and, you know, it's great. You know, it's a lot of yes men sometimes, you know, and you have to try and know, you learn where the difference is and what's important. That's, I think, you learn what's important. I've learned what's important, and sometimes the hard way. But it just changes your mind more than probably other people's minds. You know, you kind of approach things a bit differently because you don't, you know. And I remember having a friend that I knew all my life, and he said to me, and I met him at a wedding shortly after Eurostar, and he was a bit kind of, and then I met him a few years after. He says, you know that time when I met you, that, like, I hadn't seen you for a while, and that whole Eurostar thing and the whole thing, I actually didn't know what to say to you.
Right.
I didn't know how to converse with you because I thought you were a different kind of level of person then or something. And that was weird, you know, that they had kind of in their minds catapulted me to this. And I know this guy since I was a kid, and we used to ride bikes together and do all that. You know, but I hadn't seen him maybe for that period of time or for a while. And, you know, we were off doing all things. And then whenever we did meet, kind of post-Eurostar and Eurovision, and there was a lot of hype still around that maybe same year, 2003, so I was thinking it was, and he just said, you know, and I could see that he was going to, you know, didn't know how to handle this person that he knew all his life, but now that people were coming up and asked for photographs while we were chatting, you know, and doing things like that, and that's weird. You know, that part of it throws you a bit, didn't like that, you know, I don't like, prefer that, but that's just, it's a byproduct of, I suppose, all the stuff that was going on, you know.
Yeah, I suppose it's kind of, it's par for the course, isn't it?
Yeah, you just don't know. And then you learn and you realize, you know, what's important. You figure out what's important, and, you know, pick the things you've done, the mistakes you made along the way. And, you know, you pissed off people, and maybe you know, you try and do some good. You do a lot of good. You're going along and try to do. But then there are times you look back and you go, Jesus, I handled that very badly, you know. Because you're kind of you can be a bit blinkered, you know. Mm. Yeah, so and you're trying to protect yourself, trying to protect your kind of whatever that is, you know, you're trying to protect yourself from external factors of people, you know, you don't want to hear what they're saying behind your back,
Did you find it hard to stay in the middle? And what I mean by that is, for every person who's telling you you're brilliant, there's probably people telling you you're not good. Is it hard to stay in the middle and kind of not get too high or too low with the success or the criticism?
That's the trick. That is the hardest thing, because, you know, with great highs, you know, you've heard this, great highs, great lows. And, like, I've had some low times in the last 20 years, you know, but I've had good family around me. I've had reasons to get up, even on bad days, you know, things to do. And, you know, family to rear, all those kind of things. How to put bread on the table. You just have to figure out a way through it. You know, and I always had a good support structure around me, really. There was always a few people I could ring if the chips were down, you know. And it's important, you know, to try and keep that circle around you, or, people that you trust and people you know that won't bullshit you, and sort of, and yeah, it's hard. That's the trick, to try and stay in the middle somewhere, try and stay, that kind of normalized place we are. And I think I've found that in some ways, and that doesn't mean to say that I don't dip and get highs and lows and get, days where, you have to, it's business like, when you have to try and, self-motivation is a big part of what I do, and trying to find ways of motivating myself, to write and to get up and to do all the things, and to play and to find the next, song or the next, what's the next project and what's the next thing. And there's a lot of energy that goes into that. That's that you have to kind of make the plan for and figure your way through that. And that's just, it's more mental stuff, mental performance and kind of trying to keep yourself fresh and keeping your, I try and keep myself relatively fit in terms of, like, I love to swim and cycle and do things like that, keep stuff kind of physically fit, but keeping your mind fit is the hardest. It's so much harder than the physical stuff.
Yeah,
in my opinion, but it all helps. One another helps. The physical stuff, I think, helps the mental stuff.
You mentioned the mental stuff there. Obviously, that's an area I'm absolutely fascinated by, so I'm going to move that in a sec. I have a listener question here from Neve, my cousin in Donegal. A huge fan. She's buzzing to hear this.
Keep it local.
Yeah, exactly. She wants to know, what was the hardest thing about doing the Eurovision, and would you do it again?
What was the hardest thing of doing Eurovision? It was hard because, it didn't feel like a chore, let's put it like that, and these things. There were elements of it. I think the probably hardest thing for me was the fact that I felt that I let down the country when I didn't win. Because we went with, there was a single, we've got, the world was number one when I left Ireland to go to Eurovision. It was huge, that everything was everywhere. And there was this expectation then that, we're going to kind of go out there and just buzz through the Eurovision and bring back the trophy, you know what I mean? Like, with no flaw, and I knew when I got there, it was going to be a big challenge. And when I got there, there were so many fantastic acts, whatever you think about Eurovision, there's a huge amount of talent always there every year, and it's great songwriters, great songs with great CVs, and have had great, success in the past. So you're dealing with all that, a lot of countries, a lot of factors. But I suppose the hardest thing for me was just trying to keep, we had two plane loads of people. One went from Derry, one went from Dublin, chartered. So I had the most support by far in the theatre that night in the hall. And then they had a big party, and they were at a different hotel and stuff like that. They were partying, doing the whole thing, as you would expect. And so trying to keep myself just focused on singing and making sure that I got, got through the song right and trying to put it. That's the hardest thing, And if I find Eurovision, I find is that, not always the best song wins, not always the best thing. It's if you can connect with an audience somehow. I don't know, you just sometimes you click on it and it works, and it can be not the best song, but it can be the best performance sometimes. So that's all those kind of things we have. But that was the hardest thing for me, was just the fact that I felt that I'd let the country down, I'd let sort of people down, because I felt there was a great amount of expectation going out to it, that I was going to just go out there, this is going to be easy, and a lot of people had put money on me, put bets on me and stuff like that, and I was meeting people saying, oh, I have a couple of hundred on you, you're going to bring it, all these things that play in your mind. But so that was it. So I was doing the album with John Kelly, because I dealt in place with Sony at that stage, and we were doing that in London with a guy called John Kelly in Chiswick, and I flew straight back to London. I didn't fly into Ireland, so I didn't want to face the music. So that was, but I had to go there. We were trying to get an album finished, so I had a good reason to go there. But I don't think I would have, I would have found a way of probably not coming home the next, day after not winning, and somewhere. But anyway, I went to London for a few days, done whatever I had to do, and came back here, whatever the gigs were. We had a lot of gigs, so I came back to three gigs. Yeah, that's probably the hardest thing. And the other part, would I do it again? I never say never, because I know I'm about too long to know that I've had to eat my words a few times. So
we won't rule it out then.
It's the right song and the right, you know, I really have to believe in the song, you know.
Yeah.
I really have to, yeah, like, it's very hard for me, even though I didn't win Eurovision, I had such a great experience with Eurovision. You know, I would hate to paint that in any way, going back for a second time. And maybe, yeah. And, you know, I've had just so many good memories. So I don't know. I mean, but I'd never say never. But so I'm leaving the door a little bit open.
It's slightly, if that makes sense. The door is slightly ajar.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It's like, I wouldn't say never, because you just make it the right song, the right thing. And, you know, and it could be fun to go back. But I mean, yeah, they probably want somebody young and new and fresh and all those kind of things, and that's fine, you know. But yeah, and you know, I don't know. I think what Johnny Logan did will never be surpassed. You know, it's incredible to think that he wrote a song and, well, he sang a song that was written for him. He wrote a song and sang it and won. And he wrote a song for someone else and they won. You know, it's crazy to think that some, you know, that's really hard. Just even, as you can see, it's really hard now, even to get through the process. Yeah. We can't get through the semi-final. And there was a guy that went and won it three times. Yeah, you know, I wouldn't say no, but anyway, you know, one of those things.
Do you get nervous before live performances?
It depends. Depends where they are. It's funny, the festival I had, a local festival I had not so long ago, the last week or two, I was quite nervous for that because it's a local audience. And the last time, depends what the gigs is, I have to be honest, it depends what it is, and it just depends the preparation, try and prepare. I don't get, but yeah, there are times, yeah, where the nerves, it's just trying to, but yeah, I do still have to deal with that, absolutely, yeah. You know, we did a gig for in Letterkenny back at the start of the year for the Chrysler disaster. You know, there was a kind of a, and that, I just felt, it was a great night and I really enjoyed the gig actually, but it was your own audience, which is it was a tricky one to deal with if you're not dealing with, knowing what to say and what to do and what songs to sing. And so I was nervous for that. That was probably the last time I felt really bad nerves.
Yeah. And how would you deal with that nerves?
I don't know exactly. I just have little systems that I do. I try to make sure that I'm warmed up well. Because at least then I know that if it's kind of like footballer or whatever going on stage, at least if you've done the preparation, you know, that kind of like field to prepare to field type of attitude. I really believe in that. Like if I warm up properly, or if I'm getting into that place and kind of like say, okay, here's what I'm doing. So I just do, and then I know that, okay, well, I'm at my best now, or I'm pretty much, you know, I'm you know, it's when you go on and you're kind of caught on the back foot and you're maybe not prepared, or it's, you know, or you haven't had the time to warm up, or you haven't, you know, that those things can throw you. So I try and eliminate all the kind of stuff that I can control. You know what I mean? I can try and do that, and then the rest you can't. You know, you can wait to a certain extent to control it. So I control the controllables, if that makes sense, and that's how I deal with it. And then for some reason that helps me to control my nerves. Just a bit of breathing. I have a few breathing things that I do. And you can get on, you strike the first chord and you get a vibe and the nerves dissipate like that completely and you're away and you're fine. Or it can take a song or two. Or you can do a whole performance. You haven't quite dealt with it, but you're still able to find a way through those nerves of performing. I think it's just something that you learn, I suppose, to do. You know, but yeah. I have little tricks, I suppose, to do. Little things now that I do. Tend to talk a wee bit during songs of them. Nervous or something like that, you know, I'll try and suss out the room and try and think, and sometimes it's only needs a wee bit of laughter or a little bit of response from people, and then that's the nerves gone, you know, once you go, okay, they're on side or whatever it's but it's I don't have any magic answers. It's a whole, it's a kind of a list of a few things that I've learned to do over the years, I suppose, or
I am getting conscious of time. I won't keep it too long more.
Yeah.
My father wants to know about your songwriting process. What comes first, the lyrics or the chords?
For me, normally the lyric and the melody comes together. That's normally my way. Not always, but I'll have if a lyric comes into my head or something. I normally comes in, or an idea normally comes in with a tune. Or if I'm sitting there playing a few cards, just leaving the gates open for inspiration, and you're kind of footing about. Normally that'll happen where I'll get a line, like a hook, and say, oh, that's nice, that's good, and that's kind of says something that I want to say. That's a story I want to tell or something. And then I'll go back and kind of read that. Or else I'll have be complete, you know, it might be something that I've seen, that's something in my life that's inspired me, or I want to kind of get off my chest. And then that's different, because you're going kind of, you're trying to put, because your words are lines of things you want to say, so you're putting emphasis though. But for the most part, it'll be the melody and the song, the lyric will come together at the same time, and then I build the song around that. It's normally a hook line, a line of, or maybe a first line, and then, you know, a line or two, they just go, oh, I like that, and then I'm away. Yeah, so that's kind of how it happens for me. Pretty much, and then I'll build like the minute come through. I have two phones full of ideas, you know, little films. Some of them are very well developed, some of them are only lines. So that's kind of what I do. I sit down, I might get four or five in one session, I make it none. You know, it's funny, I was in England at the weekend for some gigs, and I had some time during the day, and it's kind of warming up too. So, and like four or five or six really goody kind of things that I was really vibing off came, and I just put them all down. Then what I do is I save them into a Dropbox file. And then I through those, and I'll pick out sort of the ones that I want to work on. I'll put them into another file. That makes sense. So I kind of whittle it down a bit until, and you know, some of them might be easier to finish, some of them I have to go back. And then I'll ultimately at the end of that whole process, you have to try and pick 10 or 12 songs out of that, are songs that you really want to go into a studio with, you know. And yeah. So I do a bit of recording myself now, so I can demo stuff like Derry Girl, which is my last single. I did that pretty much a lot of it at home. I had a lot of the pre-production done and a lot of the arrangement and all that. And I brought it to Tommy in Attica, and he's brilliant. And we fattened it out. But the template, even the tempo and stuff like that, he used my template, and then built the song around, which saves a hell of a lot of hassle and time. You know, I landed into the studio and he had the drummer there putting down the track. I was like, great. You know, he had, and then we built the song from there. But and we worked in the arrangement. It wasn't that it didn't change, but things like the tempo and, you know, pretty much everything was there. It was a matter of figuring out what we do. But so that helps me a lot. So I can do a lot of stuff, even acoustic guitars and stuff and vibes. Working the tempos is very important, I find. And if you have time to do that in your own space, and even sometimes you can get a nice vocal at home that you might not get in the studio, you might get a vibe and a today. So sometimes you'll see that, things like that, or VVs, on, you know, you don't have to go in there. You know, if they work, then they work. So that's kind of my process, I suppose. Sorry that I'm mixed, but that's wow. Kind of how I get from here to the studio and to, you know, the last single, I suppose, it was Derry Girl, and that was just something that was in my, well, it was obviously, you know, the name was influenced by the program. I won't say it wasn't. But there was a story there that I always wanted to kind of talk about, you know. And my granny was from Derry, growing up in the Troubles and all that kind of thing. And I kind of, I always tell the story that, you know, I have a bit of a joke that my granny was from Derry and my granddad was from Londonderry, you know, and that's how I set up the song. And it's a bit of fun, you know. And, you know, the story is that it's two people, one from the water side of Derry and the city side, Catholic Protestant, meeting back in the day and trying to navigate. A relationship through the Troubles and times, which would have been a very difficult thing. A lot of people did it, but it was frowned upon by a lot of people, and it was very difficult. So that's where Derry Girl came out of. That's done a lot of the pre-production at home, and then took it to Attica to Tommy McLaughlin, and we produced it. That's sort of the process, I suppose, in a nutshell. But it's you know, I'm not sitting down and having chat like this and people and sort of developing, because I think it helps. I used to love going and listening to people who were songwriters and seeing what, picking a little bit of everybody's. It's kind of like over the years you say, oh, that's a good way of approaching something, then you keep that, you put that into your wee box. Yeah. And you use it again. It's nice to be able, you know, like having the work with the likes of Paul and Paul Brady and Kieran Goss and these songwriters that would have been, Shane McGowan's and people like that would have been just you get a little nugget every from them, you know, here and there, you know, and it helps. I'm working on a project for Jack Tension at the minute. We've nearly finished with a friend of mine called Rob Burke. And Jack Tension, you wouldn't know, but he wrote many songs for the Eagles. Peaceful Easy Feeling would be one of them. So we have this project that we've got a lot of his demos, and we reworked his demos to our flavor. So that's a whole other thing. But just working with Jack, I wrote some songs with him over the years. And, you know, you pick up little things from these people and you put them into your own wee box and keep it somewhere in the head, and it helps, you know, the process, I think. You can see how a song that's very, like, Peaceful Easy Feeling is a good example because it's a three-card trick and it's very simplistic. Three or four cards, and it's but it's you know, a huge international
thing.
But it's just nice to see that somebody like Jack and down to earth kind of just singer songwriter type thing, and the song explodes and changes his life forever.
Often the best songs, three cards, four cards.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And you know, yeah, so I agree with you on that, you know, so there's. You can easily, you know, some of my favorite songs are just three card tricks, you know. Yeah.
The big question I ask everyone, what's the key to achieving high performance live?
Whoa. Jesus, I don't know. I think fit, you know, being fit, of my, you know, in some way for me is like, you know, keeping the mind, my body fit. That helps me. It's weird, you know. I think now I know now I'm performing singing better than I ever sang. That was something that I've tried to work on over the years and just try to improve, be comfortable in my singing and being able to pace myself through a gig, which is something that I used to not be very good at. Now I can, you know, and if you have a lot of gigs on, being able to pace yourself and I learned that, and that's just maybe through a bit of breathing and through just, you know, keeping yourself fit and keeping your mind fit and accepting what you do is what you do. And when you go on stage, you do your thing and don't try and be anybody else. Try not to, you know, you're coming on a stage where there's, you know, 10 other acts that are fantastic. But, you know, trust in your songs, trust in your performance, and be confident in this is what you do and try and bring people with you on that journey. And that, you know, if you're true to yourself and true to that process, then I think that ultimately, well, you'll get the best performance out of that. I think if you trust in your own abilities and just, you know, don't try and, you know, I always say it's something that I've struggled hard to do is that, you know, you try and compare yourself. And that's not, I feel it's bad to compare yourself because you are what you are and you do what you do, but it's good to let people inspire you, but not to be comparing yourself to them because there's nothing to be gained out of that. You know, I feel that you just do yourself, be the best version of yourself if you can, and let people inspire you, but don't compare yourself. Try not to compare yourself to them. That's, you know, you should be just doing what you do and try and be true to that, and that'll sort that, you know, comparison sort of thing out. But let people inspire you, absolutely, and learn from others, but don't compare, because, you know, when you start comparing, all this guy and that guy, they're doing better than me, and, you know, why can I not, you know, sing that note, you know, or why do I, or, you know, so be happy with what you have and, you know, be realistic and work within your parameters and work them to the best. And I think that's how I kind of get the best performance out of me, I suppose, and just trust in that.
Speaking of live performance, will you give us a tune?
Oh, cheekers, I nearly forgot about that. Yeah, we didn't talk about that.
Let's see how it goes.
All right, let's try this. This is Derry Girl. It's very high in the middle, so I might have to scream. You can sing along with me.
I'm going to mute myself just in case we get any interference.
Okay, no problem. Or it's kind of semi in tune.
Friday night, who's around? Eyes about you, let's hit the town. Take our chances, cross the bridge. figure out what the difference is. I don't know what's the fuss. Why is it always them and us? All I want's to have the crack, but one step forward, two steps back. When you take a closer look, should we all read the one big book? Who's to say who's right or wrong? We've been brainwashed far too long. But just be careful what you say. They might figure out today. You wandered over from the far side, Andy. You might need to get out of here right handy. I'm in love. I'm in love with a very girl. She's alright. She's alright. Catch yourself on. Get a grip. The dairy girls are on the rip. They don't take no prisoners, boys. Move over, muckers, cause here comes the noise. Hearts of gold, pins of steel. Granny swears they're the real deal. I believe her cause she was too. A dairy girl through and through. I'm in love. I'm in love with a dairy girl. She's alright. She's alright. I'm in love with a dairy girl. She's so fine. She's alright.
Here we go.
There's still a lot of changes. There's still a lot of changes. Yeah, there's still a lot of changes around here. Oh, yeah. Oh, there's still a lot of changes. Yeah, there's still a lot of changes. Oh, there's still a lot of changes around here. 30 years come and gone, still together and going strong. I guess there's truth in what they say. Love will always find a way. And if my wish does come true, there'll be no barriers for you. And boys and girls are free to meet on any side of any street. I'm in love. I'm in love with a dairy girl. She's all right. She's all mine. I'm in love. I'm in love with a dairy girl. She's so fine. She's all mine.
Let's go for it up high. Let's go.
I'm in love. I'm in love with a dairy girl. Yeah, she's all right. She's all mine. I'm in love.
Oh, yes.
I'm in love with a dairy girl. She's so fine. Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's all mine. Friday night, who's around? How's it about you? Let's hit the town. Take our chances, cross the bridge. Where my dairy girl still lives.
Unreal. Unreal.
There you go. Early in the morning, you know.
Lad, that was brilliant.
Live is amazing. With a bit of reverb, it's unreal.
We'll have to get you to Clamill for a gig.
I'd love to go there. I'd love to go down to
definitely.
Clamill.
We'll start it.
Absolutely.
I can't think of a better way to conclude the podcast. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
For a great support.
It's been a pleasure, Jimmy.
You're a gent.
Absolutely. Fair play to you.
Thank you.
Do well. Fair play to you. All right, man. Take care, Jimmy.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed our latest episode. If you listen on an Apple device, please consider leaving a review and a 5-star rating.